En met my op die paneel is eerstens Debbie Breitenberg. Debbie is 'n staatsaanklaer, werk hoofsaaklik met kinderregte. En sy is die skrywer van Saliger, was haar eerste boek, en Vrediger is die tweede boek. En Vrediger is die boek wat ons vanoggend gaan bespreek, onder andere. Langs haar sit Duane Aslett. Duane het 'n bietjie van 'n langer pad geloop. Duane het eers in die polisie gegaan, toe staatsaanklaer. Hoekom is julle allemaal aan die donker kant, he? En op die oomblik is jy 'n docent in forensiese rekenmeesterskap.
Ja, in die program.
In die program. Ja. Maar jy is 'n rechtsgeleerde, jy is nie rekenmeester.
Nee, glad nie.
Glad nie. En jy het ook 'n snaakse ding gedoen, jy het ementeologie.
Ja, dit is sekere snaakse ding.
Ek gaan, wel, dit is bykie anders as die ander goed. Ek gaan jou later daar oor vraag. En Duane het so pas sy doktorsgraad nog nie klaar nie.
Jy was hy wens so, ja.
Hy het sy bezig met sy doktorsgraad en jou thesis se naam is Fighting Organized Crime in South Africa.
Ja, okay.
En laaste, maar die minste, nie Andrew Brown. Andrew is ons Engelse paneellid. Andrew het, dis Duane se boek Goud Duivel. Duane se eerste boek was Skoppensboer. Andrew het hierdie fantastische boek geskryf, Good Cop, Bad Cop. En dis die laaste in 'n lang lyn boeke wat jy geskryf het. Kom ons kyk gou-gou. Jy het geskryf Inyenzi, Cold Sleep Lullaby, Refuge, Solace en Devil's Harvest. En dan het jy ook Street Blues geskryf wat dieselfde tema as Good Cop, Bad Cop.
Ja.
En jy is ook 'n advokaat in die Hooggeregshof in Kaapstad.
Dis reg, ja.
Vertel gou vir ons bietjie meer van wat jy doen. Nou, ek weet jy het gesê jy doen bietjie impact litigation, maar jy is ook met mediese litigasie besig.
Okay, ek gaan maar Engels praat, anders sukkel ons heel over die song. So I'm an advocate at the bar, and my main work is in medical work for hospitals. I represent state and private hospitals when they get into trouble. But we run a pro bono committee. So all advocates have to do a certain amount of pro bono work every year. And so we have a pro bono work that does child abuse and gender work. And that's really the focus of my work at the bar. And then I marry that with my police work. So I run the child abuse unit out of the Red Cross Children's Hospital. We do about 400 cases a year of serious child abuse that comes through the casualty department of Red Cross. And so I'm the case manager for all of those cases, making sure they go to the right place, making sure families are followed up and that kind of thing. So that keeps me busy. So it's interesting that Debbie and I are doing very similar kinds of work in child abuse. Unfortunately, there is an enormous amount of it. It feels a bit overwhelming at times. But yeah, that's the focus of my work.
Of course, you're on the opposite sides of it when you go.
Can be. So it's a bit of. I'm in a bit of a complicated position. So I've been at the bar a long time. I used to do criminal work. I don't anymore. But I used to be a defense counsel, so I've represented rapists, I've represented murderers.
He's joined the dogs.
And now I'm also a cop, so now I try and catch them. I've sat as an acting judge, so I've put them behind bars. And unfortunately, I've also been an accused, not in...
So you know the system from all sides.
I know the system very well, yeah. I've got various criminal convictions from the 80s, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that a little bit later.
So all sides, yeah.
Debbie, wanneer kry jy kans om te skryf?
Man, ek skryf gewoonlik baie vroeg in die oggende. Ek skryf tussen 2:30 in die oggend en 6:30 in die oggend. Anders is daar nie tyd nie.
Ek het gesien in 'n serie onderhoud het jy gesê jy's 'n skryfvampier.
Inderdaad.
Wat 'n baie ryk beskrywing is. Ek hoop jy suig mense se bloed uit nie.
Ek se aanklaar.
Skryf jy elke dag?
Ek probeer. Die groot rede is, dit gaan alles oor tydsbestuur, Bettina. Daar is net soveel tyd. So as jy iets wil doen, dan gaan jy tyd maak om het te doen. Maar mens wil ook nou nie, jy weet self, as mens roman skryf, neem het geweldig baie van jou ure op. So ek probeer maar so 3-4 dae week, maandag tot donderdag aan 'n roman werk, en vrydag en saterdag iets anders, soos 'n radiodrama of 'n kort verhaal of iets anders, dat jy net so bietjie iets anders doen. En sondag gee ek myself af en slaap ek laat.
Ek het ook in 'n onderhoud gesien, jy sê jy skryf ten minste 1500 woorde.
Ja, ek probeer. Ek
was grisgroen toe ek dit lees.
Mens moet dit maar net doen. Jy moet dit net doen. Hoeveel van die woorde aan die einde van die dag bruikbaar is, weet genoeg.
Ja, dis nie, maar misschien... Moes net in die gang bly. Duane, wanneer skryf jy? Want jy is besig met jou doktorsgraad. Jy is 'n docent.
Huispa,
ja, van een kooshuis. Ja. Wanneer skryf jy?
Definitief nie half drie ochend. Ek
moet die 1500 woorde dag.
Nee, dis maar gewoonlik vakanties... ja, meer in deels vakanties. Dis maar therapie. Weet, as jy nou klaar is met die studenten en dat jy nou opgehaald hierdie kwartaal, dan is het therapeutisch om wat te verdwijnen in hierdie wereld. En...
Is dit jou manier van is dit jou idee van een vakantie?
Dit is, ja.
Dit is scary.
ja, dit, ongelukkig vind het vir Tammy is dit my idee van een vakantie, ja. So,
Misschien moet ons haar ook vir
So, nee, ek, dis maal wanneer mys tyd kry, want in die kwartaal is het maar bezig, en vooral met die kooshuis ook, want as jy klaar is met klas, dan kom jy die kooshuis, dan is het kooshuis activiteite wat jy bezig hou. So, ja.
En hoeveel studenten is aan jou kooshuis?
260 mans, okay. Ja, so, hormone met twee bene, dis maar wat hulle is.
So, dis 260 times 20, of iets?
Ja.
Andrew, wanneer skryf jy? Want jy het nou nog polisiereserviswerk ook.
Ja, en drie kinders by die huis, wat nou ook een bietjie tyd vat.
Hulle is dan effens groter al.
Hulle is al groter, ja. Vir my is die antwoord hang af, eintlik, is daar een ander vraag, en dis, hoe sien een mens jouself? As ek vir Debbie vraag, byvoorbeeld, wat is jy? Is jou antwoord, ek is een skrywer? Of is jou antwoord nie, ek is een staatsaanklaar? Of is jou antwoord nie, ek is een ma? Of wat is jou antwoord? Hoe ernstig vat jy jou werk as een skrywer? Mm. En vir my is dit een hobby. Al het ek boeke geskryf wel oor die laas 15 jaar. Vir my is dit iets wat secondary is, amper. En as jy vir my vry wat is ek, sal ek nooit vir jou sê, ek is een skrywer. So I write at night when I have time, when I don't have other things that are in the way. And I don't think that's a good way of being. I don't think that's a good way of writing. I think you should take it more seriously. You should say to your family, to your friends, ek is nou een skrywer en ek skryf nou en los my uit. But I write and then someone presses the bell and someone comes for a drink and my child has an Afrikaans problem or heaven forbid a maths problem. Which because I send them somewhere else. Kan vraag jou ma. You know, but one should take it more seriously and you know, I'm envious of someone like Demi who can say, well, I block this time off because I don't and I miss it. I love writing. I love that time when I'm writing, but I don't push things away to make that time.
Do you seriously love writing or do you enjoy the fact of having written?
No, I hate the fact of having written.
So the process?
It's the process. Okay. If I could write and nobody would read it, I'd still write.
Well, most writers would say it's the other way around. They hate writing, but once the thing is there, it's good.
No, for me, there are two difficulties with finishing a book. The one is that it's going to go out there into the public. And that's a terrifying idea. Particularly in a book like Good Cop, Bad Cop, which is all about me and my emotions and how I feel about what I've dealt with. It's a very personal, it's a very vulnerable book. When I talk about it, I often end up crying because it's so personal. And yet, there it is in exclusive books and anybody can pick it up and say, oh, well, who's this person? And he can't write or why is he such a wuss or whatever, you know. So that's one part of it. It's very vulnerable making to put your book out there. And the other thing is if it's a novel, you've got to let go of the friendship that you have with your characters. And that is very, very hard. You live with your characters for maybe a year, maybe 2 years, and then it's done. And unless you're doing a series, and I think that's why many of us write series, because we just can't. I mean, Dion Mayer says he just can't let go of his main character, so he just reinvents him all the time. And I understand that. It's very hard to actually then walk away from it and say, okay, putting you to bed, I'm going to do something new now. So for me, it's the process.
Okay. Debbie, hoe doen jy jou navorsing? As ek nou kyk na Vrediger, daar is 'n klompie verskillende goed wat dit duidelik is jy baie navorsing oor gedoen het. Praat bietjie met ons oor jou proses.
Man, ek is 'n vreeslike wye leser en ek is 'n vreeslike nuuskierige leser en ek is 'n internetmisbruiker.
Misbruiker,
ja. En ek, met verwysing na Vrediger spesifiek, denk ek jy verwys daarna die navorsing wat ek gedoen het oor die ridders. Nou, toe ek Vrediger geskryf het, was dit die 800-jarige herdenking van die Magna Carta.
Ja, dit was nou nogal vir my een vreemde stimulus vir een boek. Maar
man, ja, ek denk jy sal, as jy Vrediger mooi gaan lees, dan sal jy sien baie van Vrediger gaan oor grondregte en die konflik tussen die mense op die grond en hulle aansprake op grond, waaroor die Magna Carta ook tot stand gekom het. Nou die hoofkarakter in Vrediger is 'n ou met die naam van Willem Maarskalk. Hy is gebaseer op 'n ridder wat werklik bestaan, die raadgewer van koning John Lackland, 'n ridder met die naam van William Marshall. En ek het toe nou maar, omdat dit vir my die kruks was waarom die story gedraai het, het ek maar die name ook so bietjie net, hoe kan ek het stel, respekte aanbetoon. Die boer wat vermoor is vernoem na koning John Lackland, koning John die Eerste, Evil King John.
En dan Willem Maarskalk, William Marshall.
Johannes Kleinveld, John Lackland. Maar dit is waar het vandaan gekom het, en het was nie dat ek doelbewus gaan navorsing doen het nie. Ek lees dit in elk geval. Dit is maar net die ene ding het voortgevloei uit die ander.
Maar dan ook bijvoorbeeld, jy het oor suiker klompje goed gesê wat ek gedink het, okay, iewers het jy gaan oplees.
Nee, ek het nie gaan oplees nie. Een van my goeie vriende is 'n suikerboer in Pongola. En ek het vir hom gaan vra hoe werk suikerrietplantasies. En dit is nogal 'n geweldige interessante ding. Dit is geweldig wetenskaplik. Ek het dit nooit geweet nie. Dat hulle kyk na die suikerkonsentrasie in 'n stingel suikerriet. Wow. Okay. Ek waardeer die sjokolade aspekte daarvan.
En slankie suiker in jou koffie kan gewees als reg.
Is fijn, maar die wetenskap daarachter het ek nou niks van geweet nie.
Duane, jy het 'n hele thesis gehad om te gebruik as jou basis.
Ja, dis seker die lekker ding. Dis deel van my werk om navorsing te doen. En dit was my uitgangspunt om te sê, jy doen al die navorsing en niemand gaan dit lees nie, want let's face it, niemand lees jou op jou ideas.
Al jou promoter moet dit lees.
Ja, as hulle dit nog lees ook, ja. Al die werk, en weet al gebeur niks al mee nie, so het ek die idee gekry van dit kan lekker achtergrond vorm vir romans, ja. En ek denk die uitdaging is om dan nie so technisch te raak met die navorsing dat jy vergeet, jy moet eindelijk een story skryf hier, ja. So nie. So dit is eindelijk wat die gevaar is daar.
En wat vir my ook interessant was, jy het een gedeelte van jou verhaal speel in die hedendaagse tyd af, en een gedeelte in die 1900s, 1900 tot 1904 omtrent.
Ja.
Wat se navorsing het jy gedoen om daai tydperk bietjie reg uit te beeld?
Ja, dit was ook uitdaging, want ek wou nie een verhaal, weet, een historiese ding skryf oor die boereoorlog nie. Ek wou meer net die verhaal van die goud, wat gebeur het met die goud wat in Pretoria was in daai tyd. En ek was al baie gelukkig, want daar was 'n hele paar boeke in die biblioteek oor die kreermiljoene wat van die ou profies bepik geskryf het. So ons het hele Afrikana afdeling. Yeah. So dit was lekker om daar te kon gaan oplees daaroor. So dit is maar dit is definitief nie gemik om die hele, jy weet, historiese feite van die oorlog te wees nie.
Andrew, your book is non-fiction. Did you keep a diary or did you write as things happened? How did you decide which portions of the story you're going to put in the book and which you'd rather not? What process did you follow?
It's been quite an interesting process for me to write non-fiction because I much prefer writing fiction. And I wrote Cold Sleep Lullaby and it did really well. And I wasn't taking myself seriously as a writer at that stage at all. I still don't particularly. But the book did really well, and it was a bit intimidating, and I felt like I would never write again. It's quite strange that the way that works. I won the Sunday Time Prize, And I remember walking up to get the prize and thinking, well, I'll never do this again. I'm never going to write another word because I can't.
It's very intimidating.
That's it. Yeah, it's the end of it. And it was my second book and it was all over. And after a long time, I thought, okay, what I'll try and do is I'll try and write about myself as a police officer. Because that's going to be so easy. I've got all the stories. It's just about me. I don't have to make up other characters. And it'll be the easiest thing in the world. And I sat down and started writing nonfiction. And it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible to write about yourself. Because it feels so self-indulgent. Mm. And it, every word that you say, you think, oh, you know, somebody's going to roll their eyes when they hear that. Or it, yeah. And I find it very, very difficult. So after I wrote Street Blues, I didn't write any more nonfiction and I wrote more fiction. And then I came back to write Good Cop, Bad Cop just because I had so many stories that I had written. So when something happens on duty, the next morning I will write the bare bones of what happened. I wanted to try and make sure it's accurate as possible. And so eventually you have all of these stories without any padding to it, but just the outline of stories. And then I decided it was time to go through them and see if I can't put something together. You've got to also have a sort of a theme to it. You can't just throw out, you know, stories one after the next. So for me, there is a theme in Good Cop, Bad Cop, and I had to choose the stories that then fitted in with that theme.
The next question I want to ask you specifically, you experienced police work from the other side. You were arrested as a 19-year-old. You spent time in jail. How did you go from, oh, and perhaps before people think you're a murderer, it was for political...
Klipkoi.
You were a political activist and that was what you were arrested for.
Yeah.
You discuss it in the book, but could you also just tell us why, what made you decide to, after having been on the receiving end of it, how did you go and decide to become a police reservist?
It was a long, hard journey. So as a 18-year-old, I ended up in Polsmoor in solitary confinement for a few weeks. And after that, became very radicalized. I joined the ANC underground, got arrested a whole lot more times. I got a 3-year jail sentence for public violence, which fortunately the sentence was overturned. So I had a very stormy late teens and early 20s fighting the men in blue. And what we wanted was democracy, and then we got it. And it's a bit like the dog that's been chasing the bus its whole life and then finally catches the bus. What on earth do you do with it now? So 94 came and we had what we wanted. And it was interesting how that played out for all of my comrades from the ANC. Some people were politicians. People like Trevor Manuel and others went into politics and they were very, very happy there. But the vast majority of us weren't politicians. We were activists. And now there wasn't anything to be active about. And a lot of people got depressed. A lot of people left the country. I mean, it's bizarre. You've got what you wanted, but I know people who had nervous breakdowns. I know people who went farming because they just couldn't cope anymore, didn't know what to do with their lives. And a lot of us looked around and said, okay, what do we do now? And I did firefighting, and I went to the SPCA, and I worked in an orphanage, and none of it felt like it was the right thing for me. And then
this was now on top of your legal work?
On top of my legal work, yeah. Just looking for a place to put that activism back in. And then in 1998, a friend of mine said, but the police force, which is traditionally been white and male and an apartheid-supporting security structure, is now supposed to be our new democratic police force. Mkhonto Sizwe soldiers have been integrated into it, and it's, you know, it's an impossible task, and that's really where we need to be putting our efforts, is to get the police force transformed and get it working properly. And I'd never even contemplated that. And I went to talk to them, and I remember saying to the colonel that I spoke to, look, I'm interested in doing this, but I'm never putting a uniform on. And he said, well, we'll go away, and when you're ready to put a uniform on, you can come back and talk to me, because that's not going to work. And then I went back to him a few months later and said, okay, I'll put the uniform on, but I'm not carrying a gun. He said, go away and come back when you're ready to carry. When you're ready to be a policeman, come back, but until then, go away. And it took me months. Months and months and months. Eventually in 1999, I went and said, okay, let's try this. I'm not making any promises, but let's try. And the first day I put that uniform on was a very interesting day, very hard day. But I don't regret it for a moment. It's been amazing.
And you put a gun on.
And I put a gun on. And I've been doing it for 18 years now. And I don't regret it at all. It's been a cathartic experience for me. And I've met fascinating people. I've met people in the riot squad who shot me. I met, it's a story I've told many times before, but I've met Warrant Officer Minnick, who's a permanent force policeman, and I worked very closely with him. And one day we were out the back of Mowbray Police Station having a cigarette. And he said, "So, Brian, why was you in 1989? I said, "No, I was at UCT throwing stones." "Oh," he said, "yeah, I was in the riot squad." I said, did you wear a brown jersey? You had quite long hair." I said, "Yeah, that was me." He said, "Yeah, I remember, I shot you in the leg with a tear gas canister." And my response was, "Yeah, you were the fucker I threw that half stone at, wasn't I?" And that's the joy of South Africa, is that that could have been a moment where we looked at each other and said, "I want nothing more to do with you."
Yeah.
You know, you shot me, and he could have looked at me and said, "Jake Klipkakwena mo," and that could have been the end of it. Being South Africans, we gave each other a hug and had another cigarette, and we're good friends. And he works in the homicide unit now in Nyanga, and I go and work with him as a reservist from time to time to give him support there. And we're good friends. And I mean, that is the joy of this country. It really is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kom ons praat oor titels. Hoe het jy op Vrediger gekom?
Mans, Vrediger het soort van gevloei uit Saliger uit. Al twee titels is ironies. Saliger het geslaan op onder andere om dood te gaan en ook heiligmaking. Vrediger weer is 'n ironiese verwysing na wat 'n mens verwag van 'n plattelandse landskap. Die platteland lyk rustig, maar het is eintlik soos 'n dam vol visse. Boop lyk het glad en onder gaan dinge so. En dit is maar waar die titel vandaan kom.
Doen?
Dit is my baie weird. Ek is baie swak met titels. Ek het, ek stel vir my studente met hulle skripsies, maar nie worry oor die titel nie, die komitee gaan vir jou in geval sê wat jou titel is. So, met Skoppensboer het ek aan die titel gehad en uiteindelik het was die voorstel, kom ons gebruik die gedig as die, so met hierdie ene het ek gesê, okay, ek gaan nou die titel die moet soek. Toen ek een aand, slapeloos aand, gaan sit met een woordeboek en een thesaurus en is die Afrikaanse spreekwoordeboek en so begin blaai en alles om goud gesoek en toe kry ek die spreekwoord in die klauwe van die goudduiwel.
En wat beteken?
Wat beteken gierigheid, jy is in die klauwe van die goudduiwel. So, toe ek dit gebruik, en toe jy weet, soos my was een woord titels is mos beter as vier, so, toe word verkort na goudduiwel toe. Maar ja, so die oorspronkelike idee was in die klauwe van die goudduiwel, is die, maar nie, het gaan maar oor gierigheid in die boek.
En die hele boek gaan oor gierigheid.
Ja, dit is eigenlijk die subthema seker, ja, as dat so iets is.
And Andrew, good cop, bad cop, confessions of a reluctant policeman.
It's interesting for me, I mean, I don't know with Debbie and Duane, when you write, if you've got a title in mind at the beginning, but I've repeatedly had the experience of having a title in mind, and when I'm writing the book, I have this idea, this is what it's going to be called. Sometimes I even have a cover in mind. And then you'd give it to your publishers, and they go, "Oh no, that's not going to work." And then they change it, and they give you a new title, and you kind of okay. And there's a certain humility in stepping back and saying, "Okay, well, you know the market better." That's good. So this was going to be called "In the Line of Fire," okay. And they said, "Nah, I like it." And they came up with "Good Cop, Bad Cop," which I hated. I said, "It's just, I don't know. It just sounds bland. It sounds wrong." So I worked through it, and we worked through the editing process. I realized that actually they've got it completely right. That is exactly what the book is about. Mm. The book is about being a good cop and being a bad cop at the same time. It's not about two different people. It's about being me. And sometimes I'm a good cop, and sometimes I get it wrong. And that's because I'm a human being, and being a cop is incredibly difficult. Mm. So, in fact, the title works. But Refuge, for example, when I wrote the book, it was going to be called Abiyomi. That's in my mind. And if you go onto my computer, you won't find Refuge anywhere. You will find a book called Abiyomi. Devil's Harvest was going to be called Leaving Juba. If I think about Devil's Harvest, I still think of it as Leaving Juba. So it's a hard process to let go of those titles if you've started with them. But ultimately, it's got to be a title that people understand. People buy books based on mainly on cover and title, that first look of it. So you walk into whatever the bookshop is and you see it, you want to be grabbed by it. Maybe you're looking for an author you know, but ultimately I think you're looking for that first initial interest.
Yeah.
And publishers know what that is. We, us lawyers and writers, we don't know.
We're just there.
And what I find very often, it's the marketing department that makes those decisions.
Yeah.
Interestingly.
Yeah.
DB, al drie van julle, om die waarheid te sê, lever geweldige sociale commentaar in julle boeken. En Vrediger bijvoorbeeld op een stadium dan klaar die politiebeamte onder andere dat daar nie crime kids is nie. Dat die politie under-resourced is. Die selle kom deur in jou boek, Andrew.
Ja.
Wil julle ietsie daarover sê? Is het belangrijk vir julle om die type issues uit te lig?
Ek dink die mens gaan doelbewus en jy lig die issue uit nie, Bettina. Jy moet onthou, een Vrediger en Saliger het al twee hofwerk as 'n agtergrond, dit is semi-hofdramas. En jy skryf noodwendig uit 'n milieu wat vir jou bekend is. Die sosiale kommentaar, dink ek, word so half nie doelbewus deel van die story nie, alhoewel ek dink het, as jy nou terugstaan, vorm dit een groot deel van die story, maar dit is nie iets wat jy vooruit gaan beplan nie, daar is nie kraamkiets nie, punt. Dit is die werklikheid, daar is nie. Die politie sikkel nie net hier daarmee nie, hulle sikkel in Kaapstad daarmee, hulle sikkel in Pretoria daarmee, want daar is nie kraamkiets nie.
Andrew?
I think as South Africans, we underestimate how socially aware we are. Mm. As in my writing part of my life, I interview a lot of international writers who come over and I talk to them. And I think you'd be amazed the extent to which so many international writers really aren't socially aware. Mm. They really are writing a novel, a romance, a crime thriller that's actually got no social commentary in it at all. And I'm always amazed by that. I think as South Africans, we think, as South African writers, take Dion Meyer, for example. I haven't read Duane's book, so I can't say. No, I want to because I've been interested in what I've heard. But if you take someone like Dion Meyer, Dion will tell you, I'm not a social commentator at all. I don't write because of social commentary. But if you read any of Dion's books, it's full of social commentary. As South Africans, we can't get away from it. We are so socially aware of the issues that our country, and that's marvelous for me, that we can't write product kind of books. I won't tell you his name, but I interviewed an American writer who's possibly one of the most successful, financially successful crime writers in the world. And he said,
his initials are not JP.
Yeah. And he said, writing is like manufacturing. You're making a product that is going to sell. And I know what sells. And so when I sit down to write, I set out my plot, I set out my characters, and I write it, and off it goes, and I know it's going to sell. And if you read one of his books, absolutely, it's completely formulaic. It's frankly, for me, completely uninteresting, and there is not a jot of social commentary in it. But I think we underestimate just how aware we are and how in touch we are with social issues as South Africans. And I think that's brilliant.
Wat ek interessant gevind het van jou boek, Duane, is op een stadium is jy bezig om, en ek weet nie of het doelbewus was, nie, miskien moet jy nie daarover praat, om oor die witmense angst, oor sy plek in die samenleving. Dit kom bykie deur. Kan jy iets van jou, hoe jou kop gewerk het, toe jy daarover geskryf het?
Ja, ek dink, soos Andrew gesê het, beskryf van wat jy weet, en obviously op die pikkamp is,
is jy
baie bewus daarvan. Ek is baie gelukkig in opsig. Ek was op Mafeking campus vir 4 jaar. So ek het nie, weet, daar, partij van die mens wat die pik is nou al 20 jaar daar. So vir hulle is dit nou, wat gebeur nou, wat gaan aan? Weet, so dis vir my lekker om te kan terugsit, want ek het die ander belewenis gehad op die Mafeking campus, waar teens Edolf daar gekom het as visiekanselier, en ek praat nou seker 'n bietjie uit die huis uit, maar,
dit gaan net op camera geneem word, is wat.
waar ek van die Mafekingse perspektief af kon sien, maar hier is nou een potje persoon, wat nou die visiekanselier is, en wat gaan met ons gebeur hier op Mafeking, jy weet, en ek was daar op die senaat, so ek kon dit beleef. En nou sit ek aan die ander kant by die potje campus, en nou is Dan Gordy, wat my rektor was by Mafeking, hy is nou die visiekanselier, so dis nou net mooi Omgekeerd. En ek het iewers, het was 'n ou Afrikaanse reeks waar iemand gesê het, jy is 'n skrywer, gesê het, jy is ou wat terugsit en net observe. En weet, dis wat ons skrywers doen, weet, as jy daai tipe van, soos jy sê die sociale, ek het nie eens geweet, ek het sociale kommentaar gelever nie, maar dit is lekker om te hoor. Maar ek denk, mens moet bietjie terug, jy weet, ons sit terug en kyk, en dit is wat ons dan gebruik vir ons, om te skryf, en so jy sien al hierdie paniek wat bietjie opvlam hier so op die kampus, so ek denk, dis seker maar die invloed daar. Ek het nie, wat weer, soos jy sê, dis nie doelbewus nie, maar, ja. Mens sien dit nou maar mos, want jy beweeg daar. En jy het
geweldig baie sociale kommentaar oor, jy praat oor Afrikaans, die rol van Afrikaans, die rol van die man, jy speel bietjie met die gedagtes van die rol van die polisie specifiek,
ja.
en dit lyk asof by al drie van julle, daar 'n mate van ontnigtering met die systeem is. Andrew, in your book, for instance, you talk about when the satellite office was opened
at Masipumelele,
and how they totally did not go into the community, and your experience of that. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I suppose the theme of the book is more serious than my first police book. So I wrote Street Blues. There's a lot of humor in it. What I was trying to do with Street Blues was to show people what is it like to be a policeman or a policewoman and to get some sympathy, really, for how hard the job is. Good Cop, Bad Cop is a bit more serious, and people have asked me why, and I think part of the answer is, after Marikana, there isn't really much humor left in policing. Marikana changed everything for me, for all policemen and women. Marikana was a defining moment in our policing history. So the book is more about my concern about what the police force is being used for, that we're increasingly being used to quell social discontent. So what we're supposed to be is a police service, and that means you're meant to be in the community helping communities better themselves. That's what it says in the Constitution. That's our purpose in life, is to assist with the betterment of communities. And Masipumelele was a community I was very involved in. And Masi, which if you don't know, it's a township just outside Komaki. So you've got very affluent Komaki, you've got struggling Ocean View, which is a colored township full of drugs and poaching, and then you've got Masipumelele, which is the ignored township. It's not supposed to be there, it's not on the planning map, nobody really cares about it, and policemen don't ever go in there. And so they got angry, understandably, and they started burning tires, and eventually they started burning boats and all kinds of interesting things on the road that goes past to Komaki. And we were called in to quell the riot. And when I spoke to community protesters and said, why are you doing this? They said, well, we never see a police officer in our community. But the moment I burn a tire on the road to Komaki and nobody can go and get their coffee from the Vida Cafe, then I start seeing police officers. So every day I'm going to burn a tire and every day I'm going to see policemen in my community. And that, for me, was a very telling comment. And eventually, very slowly, the politicians got to work and they said, okay, we'll open a satellite police office in Masipumelele. And I was the first commanding officer of that little... It was actually a mobile unit, yeah. So it was basically a delivery truck that we turned into a police station. One of the constables said, well, that's good because we can drive it out of here if we need to. There's a certain amount of cynical humor in the police force. But what was so annoying for me was that there was the opening of this satellite police station in Masi, and it was a bigger moment, and we all got called up to come and go there. But... the opening didn't happen in Masi. The opening, because Masi was too dangerous for the high-level politicians and the high-level police officers to go. So the station was actually driven to a school outside Masi that was much safer, and it was opened there, and the Deputy Minister of Police, who I refer to in the book as Waddling, so I'm waiting still to get into trouble for that, waddled across with her scissors and cut the ribbon. And my constable standing next to me said, ah, well, there's all our problems solved now, of course. And then she waddled back into her gold Audi and left. And then we drove this little mobile unit into Masipumelele to start policing Masi.
And were any of the community at the opening?
No. They were supposed to be bussed in, but it was on a Friday morning. So those people who had work were at work. And those people who had children were looking after their children. And so there was nobody from Mussi. So it was full of DA and ANC politicians jockeying for, like, whose idea was this and who gets the credit for this satellite police station. I do hate politicians. So. it's a long story, but just to finish that story, what was incredible was that there were three of us on duty that first morning. So Mussi's been burning for weeks and weeks and weeks. And now there's this little satellite police station. And there are three of us on duty, me and two constables. I'm a sergeant. So now we've got to decide, okay, so now how do we police? What do we do? How do we stop ourselves getting killed, quite frankly? And what we did is we took our guns off and put them in the safe. We went to Ocean View and we put our guns in the safe and we came back unarmed. And we took our bulletproofs off and we left them in the station and we locked this little mobile unit and we did foot patrol. And we did a day's foot patrol unarmed with no bulletproof in Mussi. And it was possibly one of the best policing days of my life. And we got nothing but accolades. We got nothing but hugs. We got nothing but, would you like some tea? Come inside. Who are you? What are you doing here? Haven't seen a policeman on footbeat here before. And that became the policing model for Mussi for the weeks that I was in charge of that station. So it was an extraordinary experience, but also a troubling experience in terms of the politics of it.
Mm. Yeah. Debbie, jy en Dwayne praat al twee in julle boeke of julle lewer kommentaar op prokureurs. Jou karakter, Willem, wat 'n prokureur is, sê op 'n stadium, hy is maar nie die agent vir die lewendes en die dooi is.
Inderdaad, ja. Hy praat namens hulle.
Precies, maar want dit is eintlik baie siniese manier om te kyk daarna.
Man, ja,
ek dink vechter vir reg en geregtigheid.
Ek dink mens begin as 'n kampvegter vir reg en geregtigheid en dan kom jy agter as die tyd verbygaan. Jy raak 'n spreekbuis vir jou kliënt. Ek wil hulle sê mos geen verwysing na jou nie. Dit is 'n aanklaersgrappie as ek dit so kan stel. Prokureurs is soos 'n jukebox.
O, okay.
Ja, solank as wat jy geld ingooi, sing hy prokureurs en advokate. Maar
ek en Andrew doen al twee pro bono weer.
Ach, ek is baie, so lief vir julle.
Ja, ek kon nie eens sien doen nie.
Maar ja, Willem is geweldig sinies. Ek dink almal van ons wat 'n lang tyd of 'n lang genoeg tyd in die howe rond beweeg, begin 'n sekere mate van sinisme ontwikkel, want jy kom agter, niemand is so moreel goed as wat hulle dink hulle is nie, en niemand is so moreel sleg as wat hulle dink hulle is nie. Almal is maar permanent besig om hierdie hoe kan ek dit noem, soos 'n koordanser, jy loop die koord die hele tyd. En as 'n mens te veel morele waarde heg aan 'n aksie na die kant toe of na daai kant toe, dan verloor dit ook maar sy betekenis. So wat Willem doen is, as jy dood is, dan hanteer hy jou testament. As jy lewendig is, gaan verdedig hy jou in die hof.
Maar hy sê ook iets baie interessant oor geregtigheid op 'n stadium en vra, maar is Ketiwe, dis nou die jongvrou wat vermoor was in die Suikerland, goed, is haar geregtigheid dan nou anders as Johannes Kleinveldsen?
Inderdaad.
Wat oor die regstelsel spesifiek kommentaar lewer?
Spesifiek, dit gaan oor Johannes Kleinveld is 'n geweldige vermoënde boer en hy word vermoor op sy plaas. En daar is ek soveel uit polisiemanne, speerders, forensiese deskundiges, wat klon ja in die dorpie, nou kon oplever, is allemaal daar om hierdie moordenaar te vang. Ketiwe is Johannes Kleinveldse plaaswerker. Sy op sy huiswerker. Sy word vermoor in 'n suikerrietland. En al wat gebeur is die polisie kom al die lyk. Met ander woorde, werk het vir haar anders, omdat sy arm is, as wat dit vir Johannes Kleinveld werk, omdat hy ryk is, moet sy met minder tevrede wees, en ek dink dit sluit aan by wat Andrew nou vertel het van Mussi.
Absoluut.
Jy weet, dit is maar 'n vraag wat mens aanhoudend bly vra.
En is frustrerend as jy in die systeem is.
Ongelooflik, jy het geen idee met hoe min die mense op die grond tevrede moet wees nie.
Ja.
Wel, ek dink jy het, maar die meeste mense het nie. Ek werk nou vooral met indigent kinders. En dit is verstommend met wat se swak sorg van die staat, wat se swak sorg van die stelsel af hulle tevrede moet wees. en hoeveel van hulle deur die stelsel in die steek gelaat word. Dit dryf my teen die muur uit.
Ons gaan glad nie oor die grants nou praat, hoor. Want dan sit 'n gesprek op.
Ja. Ek praat glad nie oor grants hier nie, Bettina. Ek praat dood eenvoudig oor die diens wat hulle kry in 'n strafstelsel. Nee, hulle kry dit net nie.
Ja, nee, ek verstaan. Duane, jou hoofkarakter Rex Reinicke is 'n prokureur wat besluit om 'n geheime agent te word en klompie ander goeders doen. Maar op 'n stadium sê hy sy kantoor, sy prokureurskantoor het leer gevoel as wat ek kan nou nie presies onthou nie, het het so leeg gevoel die vier mure as wat het was voordat sy vrou dood, toe sy vrou nog gelewe. Daar is geen vervulling vir hom in sy werk nie. Was dit 'n vroeë midlife crisis vir hom?
Nee, ek dink dis ook maar daai, jy weet, wat ek gesien het in die polisie en toe ek nog aangeklaat, ek dink dis nou baie anders. Ek dink dit is ongelukkig ook wat die polisie mee bietjie sukkel. Daar was 'n vreeslike kameraadskap, veral nie spesialisteenhede. Jy weet, jy nog die Sanaps en die voertuigtak, jy weet, daai ouens het 'n hengse kameraadskap gehad en ons as aanklaers ook, jy weet, die streekhof aanklaers het 'n groot kantoor gehad wat ons allemaal gedeel het, so jy het jou sake bespreek en daai is, ek dink daai is siniese view van die prokureurse daai, jy weet, ek het 'n collega gehad wat na die beskuldig toegegaan het wat nog onverteenwoordig was, toe sê hy van, hoor, gaan jy vir jouself lieg of gaan jy een van die ouens vir jou te lieg? En ek dink dis waar daai siniese dis nou maar daai kameraadskap, jy weet, en die prokureurs het dieselfde met ons gehad.
Ek wou nou net so, ons het ook ons stories.
Ja, maar dit, ja, ek dink dit was nice om te beleef daai kamera. So ek dink dis maar waar dit vandaan kom. En jy het altyd as aanklaer gevoel jy is deel van iets bietjie groter as jou salaris einde van die maand. So ek dink dit was maar en ek moet sê die ander ding was dat jy was gesien, jy het altyd gesê jy is 'n officer of the truth. So jou werk as aanklaer is om die hof by die waarheid uit te bring. So ek kon nooit verstaan as aanklaer is die skuldbevindings kry dan is almal geluk met daai skuldbevindings. Vir my was dit soos 'n hoekom mens om geluk uit sy werk gedoen het gekom waar die waarheid is. Dis as dit 'n onskuldbevindings was, moet jy ook vir hom sê geluk, want dit was ook die waarheid. Jy weet, hy kom by die waarheid, maar so daai, ek dink daai is maar net die siniese view wat kom uit daai ondervinding uit van daai kameraadskap oor die aanklaers.
Maar wat julle nie besef nie is ons het presies dieselfde eet afgeleer om die mense te bring.
Ek weet dit, ja.
En dan lag hulle.
Jou Rex Reinicke, anders as Andrew se polisieman wat se vangwa langs die pad amper gaan staan. Hy is 'n karfreak en hy het allerhande vinnige karre. Vertel vir ons bietjie daarvan. Is dit 'n belangstelling van jou?
Of, ja, dis seker maar 'n bietjie persoonlike, maar ek moet sê ek het was in begin baie bekommerd daaroor om dit te doen, want dit kan bietjie klisjé wees, maar ek is maar karfreak. Ander tydskrif gelees waar iemand gegaan het en gekyk het na voertuie of karre wat 'n karakter, hoofkarakter gevertolk het. Mm-hmm. Weet iets soos Stephen King se Christine, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang van Ian Fleming. So vir my, ek probeer, ek weet nie of ek reg kry nie, en as jy moet vra, is dit dalk nie. Maar vir my ek wil hê die kar moet ook 'n karakter wees in die boek.
Jou voertuie is 'n groot karakter in die boek.
So dis maar die, ek probeer ook maar nog 'n karakter skep in die voertuig, maar dit kom uit my liefde vir karre seker.
En jy het jou karakter ry 'n motorfiets. Ry jy motorfiets?
Nie self nie, ek ry graag saam met my man. Hy het 'n groot motorfiets, maar ek is te kort. Ek sou maar net vas.
Ek kry mense kleiner motorfiets.
Nee, ek kan nie op 'n trapfiets ry wat vorentoe gaan nie.
Dit was my baie interessant hoe dit al drie van julle voertuie op 'n manier gebruik. Dan jy het byvoorbeeld die beeld van die krokodil wat die hele tyd in jou verhaal vorentoe kom. Jy het die beeld van die luiperd.
O, ja.
Wat het julle gedink, hoekom het julle daai spesifieke beelde gekies?
Vrediger, dit gaan oor goed wat onder die oppervlakte gebeur. Nou, in ons area, ek bly in 'n area van die land wat mense dink ek oordryf, maar is regtig so. Daar is mense wat olifante op hulle plaas het. Hulle het 'n goeie vriend van ons olifant het nou dag in Olundi se hoofstraat opgeëindig, want hulle breek deur die drade. Maar krokodille en luiperds, daar's baie natuurreservate, ons is nabij Mosambiek, ons is nabij Kosibaai, dit is jou verwysingsraamwerk. En die interessante ding van een krokodil is, jy sien hom nie. Jy sien hom net glad nie. Jy kan tot het te laat is. En dit is maar basis vir my metafories van wat waar oor die story eindelijk gaan, oor daar die goed wat onder die oppervlakte gebeur. Om terug te kom na titels, toe interessant genoeg, want hierdie was so'n simpel titel. Die werkende titel vir Vrediger was die evolutie van krokodille. Toe sê my uitgever vir my nee, en Jeanette, jy weet, dit gaan nie werk nie, hulle gaan nie die boek in die fiksie afdeling soek nie.
Hulle gaan het langs Dave Peebles.
Ja, daar iwers toe. Ja, ja.
Ja, ek denk myne, ek het ook maar die natuur metafories probeer gebruik, oor als my leipaard specifiek is, dis die hele tyd met Neil Kamfer word hy gekonnoteer, en dis, as ek maar twee leerdag, leopard never changes its spots, dis moest my
ja,
Engelse.
En jou een karakter sê dit op een stadium, ja, leopard never changes, ja. Januari, ja.
Ja, en daar is die oude story moest van die padda en die skerpioen, wat ja, die, so, jy weet, ek denk, Neil Kamfer sal seker nooit sy natuur kan verander.
Maar hy is 'n fantastiese karakter, want jy weet net, hy gaan nou iewers gaan net droog maak, en jy wag vir volgende ding om te kom.
Ja, ek moet sê, dat is vir my gunsteling karakters om te skryf, want
hy is so complex en conflicted.
Ja.
Maar jou Rex Reineke is ook geweldig conflicted, op 'n manier.
Ja, ek sukkel met hom, ek moet sê. Ek dink, mens moet afstand kry van jou karakters, en ek wil glad nie hier, mense moet dink, ek is, weet, dis ek daai nie, so, en so, ek probeer so ver as moontlik, weet, ek het iemand anders gesê, dis, hy is vir my soos, ek het nooit 'n ouer broer gehad, weet, en al my pelle, het ouer broers gehad, het hulle opgekyk het op school, jy weet, so 2 jaar ouer, en hy is die hero, so vir my is Rex die fiksionele ouer broer, wat alles kan doen, wat ek nie kan doen nie, jy weet, okay. Hy rai goed, beter karre as ek, hy beklei beter as ek, daai type goed, so ja, dit is maar en die mens moet maar die karakters interessant maak.
Ja, absoluut. Jy het gekies om sal ons het noem een oudtijdse man as jou hoofkarakter te kies met regtig argaïse idees en ek sê dit met alle respek oor vrouwenregte. Willem sê bijvoorbeeld op een stadium lijksoek is nou nie vir een vrou nie.
Ja, kyk, Willem.
Hy het hierdie vreselike, dis wat vrouwe doen, dis wat mans doen.
Willem is een misplaaste ridder. Jy weet, hy is heeltemal uit tyd en plek uit. Hy is een product van, hulle sê ons as jy wil weet hoe iemand is, dan moet jy nie kyk wat die tydsgeest nou is. Nie. Jy moet kyk wat die tydsgeest was 20 jaar voor die persoon gebore is. En Willem is een product van Afrikaner opvoeding in die 40s en 50s. Hy het so groot geword, en vrouwens is nie veronderstel om te werk nie, hulle is nie veronderstel om prokureurs te wees nie, hulle is nie veronderstel, hulle moet net daar wees, hulle moet net poppies wees, en time and time again kry Willem op sy Moses, want hy is heeltemal misplaas, hy is nie verkeerde tydsgreep.
Nou wat het jou beweeg om so 'n man as 'n karakter te kies? As jou hoofkarakter te kies? Want jy is 'n verligte vrou, met baie sterke idees oor vrouwenregte.
Ek het nie regtig gedink aan Willem se houding oor vrouwenregte nie. Dit was maar deel van sy karakter.
En ek is seker van Willem dink ook nie oor sy houding oor vrouwenregte.
Nee, glad nie.
Nee,
glad nie, glad nie. Willem is nie 'n verligte man nie. Hy is argaïs.
Ek het so, terwijl ek lees, dink ek, yes, like Debbie. Dit is een baie interessante kees. is daar van die gehoor enige vrou? Ons het nog 10 minute oor.
Ek wil vrou, die taal speek Taliban.
Yes. Of all my books, it's probably my favorite title. Because I think it works well. It actually comes from a poem that was written by an American, an unknown poem. I mean, he's not a known poet at all. And I contacted him and said, you know, I've read your poem and I've read your title and I think it's just superb for a book I'm writing. Would you allow me to use it? And fortunately, he was generous enough to say, so long as I acknowledge him, which I did, I can do it. So that's where the title comes from.
That's your own title.
Yeah, and that yes, once I had that, nobody was going, marketing wasn't going to touch that one. They fiddled with every other one, but that one they weren't. And in Yenzi I got, was my title because I self-published in Yenzi. So it was my first book, and I wrote it as in Yenzi in my mind, which is the word for cockroach, which is what was the word of abuse that was used in the Rwandan genocide. So that's why it's called in Yenzi. It's about the Rwandan genocide. It's set there. And when I took the manuscript to various publishers, they all gave me the same response, which was, yes, no, this is very nice, but nobody's going to read it. And so eventually I self-published, and it did incredibly well. And then Cold Sleep was published, and then I said to my publisher, you must please edit, give in Yenzi a new cover. I mean, it used to, because you self-publish, you take it to some fairly cheap printer who then puts it together. And somebody said they really enjoyed in Yenzi, it was a book in different parts. There was a part in the bathroom, and then there was a part in the kitchen, and then there was another part in the middle. Basically, the glue at the back just all broke open. So the publisher republished with a new cover and everything, but my condition to them was you have to keep the title, which they did. But titles are an issue. Yeah.
Nee, mevrou, as jy nie direkte belang daarby het nie, gaan hulle jou nie toelaat om dit te lees nie.
Wel, as jy die beskuldigde is, dan kan jy...
Ja, as jy beskuldigde is, dan gaan jy afskrif daarvan kry. Hmm? Nee, dit is nie vir openbare consumptie nie, nee. Want hy bevat 'n groot hoeveelheid geweldige vertroulike inligting. En nee, hy's nie...
Nee, die hofsaak. Want hy die oorkonde van die hofsaak is publieke inligting.
Ja.
Dit kan mens kry as die saak afgehandel is.
Nee. Miskien moet ek net vir verduidelik, daar's twee goed, u praat van die docket, wat altyd die polisie se besit bly, en dan is daar die oorkonde van die hofsaak self. Onthou, alle hofsaake word op band opgeneem, en die ding word getik, en dit is publieke eiendom, dit kan 'n mens kry. Maar, 'n persoon, as u nou bijvoorbeeld, moordzaak waar ek jy beskuldigd is en jy het geen belang daarby nie, gaan jy nooit die docket kan sien nie. Wat waarschijnlijk gaan gebeur op een stadium, ek gaan nou van jou toe kom, Jonathan, is dat wanneer die hofzaak voorkom, die verklarings, die getuiese verklarings word aan hulle voorgehou en het word op rekord geplaas. So jy sal op een stadium dit kan sien, maar jy gaan nooit die geskrewe verklarings sien, behalwe as daar vir een of ander rede as die verklaring deel van die hofrekord gemaak word. En dis gewoonlik net wanneer die persoon lieg en verskil van sy verklaring. Ja. Okay. Maar ek kan agterna weer met een van die paneel praat. Jonathan?
Motorfiets.
nee, hy is krippel. Hy het van sy motorfiets afgeval.
I think it's one of the shortcomings in my writing that I tend to follow the same pattern, and that pattern is I have a male character who falls apart, and I have a female character who's incredibly strong and holds it all together. And I've done that repeatedly. I mean, if you look at my books right from the beginning, there's always a strong female character who keeps the ship afloat, and then there's a male character who just loses the plot completely. And I'm finding it very difficult to get out of that pattern. And I think it's partly because you write what you know. And so the male characters, yes, they're not me, but ultimately they've got all of my ambivalence and all of my insecurities and all of who I am stuck there. Whereas for me, the female characters, I can write much, with much more confidence as strong characters. So it's quite interesting. Characters are difficult for me, and it's interesting listening to Debbie talking about her male main character being someone who sounds not that likable in terms of their views. Because I've always struggled with that, and it's a bit naive in a way, but if I write a main male character who's racist, let's say, doesn't everybody think I'm racist? And so I've never been able to really develop a character, a male main character, who's ultimately not likable. So even Eberhard, who's falling apart, or Richard in Refuge, who, when I wrote Refuge, you were supposed to hate Richard. He was supposed to be despicable, and I couldn't do it. He ended up being quite sweet in the end, in a rather pathetic kind of way. And so I struggle with that. I struggle with that separation of me from character, and it always troubles me. And I'm just listening to Debbie. Maybe it's easier. I mean, could you have written that character if as a woman? Or would it have felt just too uncomfortable?
As a matter of fact, I did. Okay. I did. My main character in the first book is a similar kind of female. But I think, to come back to what you've said about writing what you know, if you work in law enforcement ultimately, whether you work in a female or a male environment, is a hugely conservative environment. Mm. And there are very, very strict demarcations. You will not easily find, there are females working homicide, murder cases, there are. But they will never be allowed into the group of brethren. Mm. They just never won't. Mm. Same with prosecutors. I mean, we can work with the police ad nauseam. They will phone my husband, who's also a prosecutor, to come and, I mean, we do exactly the same job. They will phone him to attend a scene. They will not phone me. Mm. So it's just a kind of institutional thing as well.
Mm. Mm. Ek het seker maar 'n weer ondervinding dan, want omtrent al my baase was nog altyd vroue gewees in my loopbaan. En ek het 'n artikel gelees in die Beeld op 'n stadium waar die, ek dink dit was Adrian Basson nog, ek sonder korreksie, maar toe hy nog redakteur was, en ek dink was 'n redakteursartikel. Of berig, het hy geskryf oor Christine Anderson daai tyd met die Waterkloof landing en en Tulie Maroncella en Glynis Breitenbach wat toe nog in die aanklaar was. Maar geskryf en sy vraag was, waar is die mans? Hier is hierdie drie vrouens wat veg en terugveg en waar is die mans? En dit was my inspirasie vir Goudduivel. Ek het probeer om sterk vroue karakters, weet, met Diana Kruikamp, en prof Annette Kombrink was die rektor toe ek by die PIK begin het, en toe sy daar afgetree het, is sy nou vir 'n rukkie die burgemeester van Potchefstroom. So ek het nog altyd sterk vrouens gehad wat in my loopbaan wat my geïnspireer het om dit te doen. So dit is my baie erg, een van die resensente het geskryf dat hy die boek chauvinisties gevind, en dit was vir my baie erg, want dit was glad nie my doel was om
nie resensies lees nie.
om sterk vroue karakters te hê wat bietjie wys luister, maar ons doen die ding hierso, so.
Okay. Enige ander vrae?
Karen, you think of your own books, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's social commentary, but you've got to keep it readable, I suppose. You've got to think of your readership as well. There's so much more I wanted to say in Good Cop, Bad Cop, and I would have undoubtedly been thrown out of the police force if I'd said it, which maybe my wife would have thought it was a great idea. She keeps asking, are they going to prosecute you? Are they going to throw you out? So, yeah, you've got to try and get that balance, because ultimately you've got to let the story reflect your outrage. You can't come out and say it, because you're not a journalist, you're not a politician, you're not a speechwriter, you're a writer. So you've got to let the story and your characters show what you feel, and you've got to be a little bit subtle about it, because otherwise, you know, people expect something a bit more than simply saying, well, this is outrageous and I'm telling you it's outrageous. So, yeah, I think it's the way you put it together. Your social commentaries on farm life and farm and South Africa's conditions comes through incredibly strongly, but you don't demean yourself to shouting it out in headlines and capital letters. So being a writer, I think, is more complex than, say, being a journalist. For me, it's always half full. I couldn't do the job I do if I didn't feel that way. You walk into the Red Cross Children's Casualty Unit, if your glass isn't half full,
don't go there.
Yeah.
Dit gaan die laaste vraag wees. Voordat jy vraag, excuse, Karen, was jou vraag vir al drie? Ja. So kan hulle net antwoord, dan gaan ek jou vraag toe laat, Malien.
Ek moet aansluit by Andrew, so as jy nie, kom ek stel het andersom, van die belangrikste lesse wat ek geleer het oor halfvol en half leeg glas, het ek geleer by kinders wat laag getuig het. En hulle stap uit die hof uit en mens verwag jy gaan hierdie verskriklike getraumatiseerde slagoffertjie sien wat vir die res van haar lewe totaal niks vir die samelewing gaan beteken nie. En daai kind gaan daar uit en sy gaan speel. So as die glas nie half vol is nie, dan gaan hy permanent leeg wees. Jy kan nie bekostig dat die glas half leeg is nie. Hy moet half vol bly. Dit is hoe ek het sien.
Dwayne?
Ja, ek definitief half vol. En dit is interessant, elke keer as mens negatief raak en jy begin voel, yes, ons verloor hierdie ding, dan moet jy iemand wat jou net inspireer en sê, luister, wat jy laat dink, jy wat, ons is nog geraaid, ons is op die regte pad. So, ja.
Ja. Marlene, laaste vraag.
Nee, hy wil niks weet nie, hy sê ek verveel hom. Kyk, André glo nie daaraan om fiksie te lees nie, hy weier, hy sê as hy wil gaan fiksie lees, dan sal hy sê, wat drama aanbetref, in elk geval sê hy lees elke dag stapel dossiere, hy het nie nodig om nog drama te hoor nie. Maar ek sal bitter graag wou gebruik as 'n klankbord, en partykeer sê ek vir hom, goed, dis quid pro quo, gaan sit jy nou stil, dan luister jy na hierdie paragraaf, en ruil daarvoor, sal ek vir jou kos maak vanavond, anders is dit tyd kwyt.
En op die noot gaan ons moed afsluit. Andrew, Dwayne, Debbie, baie dankie vir julle samenwerking vir die gesprek. Het was 'n baie lekker gesprek. Vir u, al drie hierdie boeke is buite. Daar gebeur het wat ons die hele tyd gevrees het. Al drie hierdie boeke is hier buite. Gaan koop dit asseblief. Dis fantastiese boeke. Ek is seker af van julle is beskikbaar om te teken.
Ja. Seker, ja.
Baie dankie.